In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 364. Today we're talking once again to Stephen Holbrook, who is the author most recently of Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State. Stephen Holbrook is a lawyer who's most well known for his involvement in Second Amendment and gun control litigation. He won two cases that he argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the author of numerous books on the subject of guns and the Second Amendment. I will be linking to some important resources, some related episodes to this one, including the last time that I had Stephen Holbrook on. All kinds of resources that, as usual, will help you get the most out of the episode. You can find all this at tomwoods.com/364. All right, here we go. My conversation with Stephen Holbrook. Steve Holbrook, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on the show again, Tom. Thank you for having me.
I should have said welcome back. We were just saying that I had you on earlier to talk about the Second Amendment. And you've got this book, somewhat recent book, on gun control in the Third Reich, in which you've gone back and looked at documentary sources and reconstructed step by step what actually happened from the end of World War I up through late 1938 and going into World War II. It's an important story, and it's a story that I think people know very, very vaguely, but they don't really know the steps. How did you go from a series of studies on the Second Amendment to this study in European history?
Well, this topic has always been bandied about in the gun control debate, but nobody ever did anything with it. If you go back to 1968, there were bills in Congress to require registration at the federal level of all firearms, or at least handguns. And John Dingell, bless his soul, congressman from Michigan, said, "This reminds me of things that happened in Nazi Germany." And those who were pushing the legislation said, "Oh, none of this ever happened. The Nazis weren't for gun control, and they occupied countries, and it was a death penalty to possess a gun." But there's no evidence they ever used registration records to look people up, look gun owners up. And I've been interested. I was just a teenager at the time, but I've been interested in that ever since. And it's an incredible gap, though, in historical literature about the Holocaust, about the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. That whole era, there's just been never anything done scholarly in regard to that. That topic. So my aim was, as you say, it goes from World War I until basically 1938. My aim was to show how the Weimar Republic passed various types of gun control legislation, specifically things like registration of firearms, requiring police permits to acquire firearms or to carry them, and how the warnings were there. The registration was passed in 1931, and the Interior Minister Warren, "Don't let the registration records fall into the wrong hands." And guess what? Less than 2 years later, Hitler came to power, and the records were in the wrong hands, and they were used to disarm political opponents and Jews.
I was if you hadn't mentioned that, I was going to. That it's like you're reading a dystopian novel when you read the step by step nature of all this. That you have the You have these records being compiled of gun owners and the acknowledgement that, well, you know, it might not be such a super thing if these fell into the hands of extremist groups. And, of course, the greatest extremist group of all then comes to power and has exactly the information they would want to have to know about potential enemies of the state and who they are and people who are armed and where they live. And it's all sitting right there. It's handed to them on a silver platter. What about people who would say, I do want to go through this history, but I want to anticipate an objection from people who would say, look, that's Nazi Germany, for heaven's sake. This is the United States. I mean, are you implicitly drawing some type of comparison here, or do you expect something like this to happen in the future? Isn't this a bit over the top?
Well, other than in the introduction, there's no mention of anything current in the rest of the book. It's pure history. Take it to mean anything you want it to mean. If somebody wants to say history repeats itself, maybe, or sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But I think we all agree there's lessons to be learned from history. And it, even just for no other reason, why don't we just get the historical record straight? And no, I don't predict that this is coming here, and I don't make any analogy whatever between current U.S. or the Western democracies and what happened in Hitler Germany. But we are concerned about privacy protections. We know that we've dealt with the incredibly shrinking Fourth Amendment for two or three decades now. And we're now we've come to the position where we know that the government, because of the release of records illegally, the government has extensive records on internet and cell phone use, things like that. So these are dangers to be concerned with. But my objective was really just to set the historical record straight. And by implication, it's a value judgment when a person chooses what area of history to focus on. But it is an important historical lesson, and it is something that we don't want to go there again with.
Let's talk about 1928, the firearms law under Weimar in 1928. Citizens could own guns. They could own ammunition under this. So in the American context, we would be told that we have quite a reasonable arrangement here. All they have to do is obtain some licenses. What's the problem here?
Well, a couple of things. Germany had no Second Amendment. It had no tradition that people were entitled by right to possess arms, no right to keep and bear arms. If you go back to the end of the Great War and the beginning of the Weimar period, you have a lot of fights between the communists and the Nazis, a lot of political unrest, changing governments, and you have actually quite a repressive attitude toward firearm ownership, particularly up through about 1923 because of the communist insurrections that were going on. And you could be shot on the spot for possession of a gun, for example. Back in one of those revolts, they were shooting Red Cross nurses for gun possession. And so 1928 comes around, and it's a relatively calmer period. And so you have the origin of requiring licenses merely to obtain firearms. So you have a record keeping of persons who acquired firearms and ammunition at that point. And then in 1931, you had registration being authorized and adopted by the large jurisdictions, Berlin in particular. And so that's really the rub. I mean, in the U.S., by law, we have a prohibition on registration of firearms. We have an instant background check when you buy a gun from a federally licensed dealer. And once you pass that check, the records have to be destroyed. And these are lessons of history were considered when that was passed. I mean, when the Brady Act, which adopted these background checks, came into being, the members of Congress actually recalled the generation of World War II and the Nazi experience as the reason for prohibiting registration. So it's the kind of policy that things can go terribly wrong with, and the example of National Socialism proved it.
1933, of course, the Nazis come to power, and it's your case study of Brandenburg is an interesting study of what can happen with these lists of firearms license holders. Tell us about what you found when you looked at that.
Well, Brandenburg was one of the German Länder or states that did not have registration they did not adopt it, but they did have licensing. And so when the Nazis came to power, the Gestapo was organized immediately. Hermann Göring was the head of the Prussian Gestapo, and he ordered that all political opponents be disarmed. And the presumption was that the communists had already been disarmed, but the main disarming took place with the Social Democrats. And so they would go down the list, the police would, and if you were considered politically reliable, that is a supporter of National Socialism, you could keep your permit. If you were a Social Democrat, which was a very moderate party at the time, by the way, they were not raving communists, or another political opponent of the National Socialists, your gun permit would be taken away. And so that was an example where I found specific records. I mean, it has the names of the permit holders and their profession and address and all of that. And the as I say, the officials would go down the list and yank the permits and presumably confiscate the firearms.
But it's not until 1938 that it becomes an actual part of the legal fabric that Jews are to be disarmed. That was not the case up to 1938. Even if there were various difficulties that you might face, you were not faced with a legal regime in which you were not allowed to be armed until 1938. What happens then?
But that was actually preceded in 1935 by Werner Best, who was second in command of the Gestapo, issuing a directive to all Stapo, meaning lower levels of the Gestapo, and all police stations in Germany, do not issue firearm permits, acquisition permits to Jews because they're a danger to public safety.
Oh, okay.
So you had a lawless regime in power. They could just issue a directive like that. And then 1938 comes along, you have Hitler's Gun Control Act, which reenacted most of the Weimar 1928 law. And that prohibited Jews from the firearms industry, but it did not prohibit their possession of guns. That comes in October of 1938, in the weeks preceding Kristallnacht. The Berlin police chief, Heldorf, sent out a directive that all the Jews had to be disarmed. They had to turn in their guns. And that's where I was able to find actual arrest warrants of specific Jews who were turning their guns in. One name popped up, Alfred Flatov. He had been an Olympic champion in the Athens Games back in 1896, won gold medals for Germany in gymnastics. Well, he was arrested. He was in line turning in his guns at the police station and said that he had registered his guns in 1932 and the records were still there. That's how they knew he had it. Had guns. And so you had this, just by decree, this general disarming of all Jews in Germany going on. And then it was not, though, until the night of November 9 to 10, you had the Kristallnacht, or Night of the Broken Glass, that this horrible onslaught against Jews in their homes, houses, businesses took place. And then you had a decree the next day by Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, that any Jew in possession of a gun would get up to 20 years in a concentration camp. But again, that was just by decree. And also, though, you had a law being promulgated by Interior Minister Frick threatening just 5 years in prison for possession of a gun by a Jew. But that was the first time they actually made it formally illegal for a Jew to possess a gun. That didn't prevent them from disarming Jews in the years before that, and in particular in the weeks before Kristallnacht.
I suppose this may be just a rhetorical question, but do you think that it's a coincidence that after the Jews are more or less fully disarmed, then you get the Night of the Broken Glass?
That you know, historians really should take a harder look at Kristallnacht being planned in advance. The Nazi account was a Polish Jewish teenager goes into the Paris embassy, shoots a German diplomat, and this is revenge of the German people against the Jewish race, which caused the whole thing, totally fabricated view of history. But perhaps this young man was set up to do that by the SS. Who knows? Historians really should look at that closer. How could it be a coincidence they were disarming the Jews throughout Germany, and then suddenly there's this attack upon the Jewish community? I think historians have made other suggestions, like, well, concentration camps were ready to throw 20,000 Jewish men into them. They had a lot of extra prison clothes manufactured. Well, hello, disarming them would be more important than any of those factors in terms of the pogrom being pre-planned.
I'm still trying to process this point that you made a moment ago, and that it's in your book, that even people who were giving up their weapons voluntarily were being turned over to the Gestapo. And as you say, you have cases of people who can demonstrate that they followed the law. In fact, the very fact that they followed the law is how they were tracked down in the first place. So what's happening here?
Well, when you study these arrest warrants, you see that there's a blank to fill in what section of the law was violated. And of course, it was left blank because it was not an offense for a Jew to possess a gun. You look at another line in the arrest warrant, and it asks for what was the offense, and it just says Jew with a weapon. And I think what was going on was that they were being turned over to the lowest level of the Gestapo, which was called the Stapo, state police. And they were probably being interrogated and released, because I know that happened actually during Kristallnacht itself, when these brown-shirted thugs would go to Jewish homes. There were cases where they would seize guns. They would ask a veteran from World War One, like, where's your bayonets from the war, or your souvenir pistol, things like that. And they would be interviewed at police stations and in some cases released hours later. So I suspect that was going on here, because the arrest warrants that we did find did not say what happened after they were turned over to the Stapo. So my guess is they were being interviewed and released. But then there was another arrest warrant we found where the Jewish man had hidden his guns with an apparent Aryan friend. And I suspect that his interrogation would have been a lot harsher.
What was the policy that the Germans adopted after they took France with regard to the private ownership of firearms by Frenchmen?
The policy in France and in all occupied countries was to put up posters immediately when the occupation started, threatening the death penalty for possession of a gun and giving owners 24 hours to turn them in. You can see one of these posters if you visit the Resistance Museum in Paris. I have a lengthy law review article in this whole episode. If you just Google my name and French occupation, you'll find it. And in France in particular, that's an area where I'm studying with the idea of doing a book. The occupation there was from 1940 to 44. But if you wind history back to 1935, you had Pierre Laval in power as the prime minister of France, decreeing gun registration. How convenient that was. 5 years later, they're occupied by the Germans, and the armistice provided that the French police will administer the country on behalf of the German armed forces, the Wehrmacht. So here you have the Wehrmacht imposing the death penalty for possession of gun. You have the French police working for them and in possession of the registration records. And we've studied a lot of in interior German documents and also newspapers from the period, and many, many Frenchmen were executed for gun possession. But it's a weird example of how gun control doesn't work very well, because in view of the death penalty, even many Frenchmen would not turn their guns in. And particularly when resistance activities started, gun possessors were really in for it. And you would have, if one German officer was killed by the resistance, for example, you would have the execution of 50 or even 100 people as hostages. They would be alleged communists and Jews, and some of them would be gun owners or people who had somehow interfered with the occupation.
Now, I realize, as you said earlier, that in this book, you're dealing purely with a historical episode and documenting it and leaving people to draw their own conclusions. But here we are in the in the intimate quarters of the Tom Woods Show, and I have an audience that will be curious to know your own thoughts regarding what conclusions we should draw from this. I mean, perhaps they're obvious, but it's not that if you have gun registration, then before you know it, you're going to have Nazi Germany. It's the lessons are more subtle than that. What are the lessons that you personally would draw from this?
Well, I just think it's important that our traditional views about the Second Amendment be preserved, that the whole idea of gun registration be rejected. I think it's just a very bad idea for a lot of reasons. Canada had long gun registration for 15 or 20 years, and they finally abolished it a year or two ago because it didn't lead to the solving of a single crime. So there's a lot of reasons not to have certain aspects of gun policy like registration. And if you want to go to the worst examples in human history, I mean, what we've recorded about National Socialist Germany, you'll find it there. So I think these are major points to consider. We should appreciate our Second Amendment values in this country and the values of the other provisions of the Bill of Rights. And we should be very careful not to go to the places that can lead to very bad results.
Today is episode 364 of the show, so the show notes page for this episode will be tomwoods.com/364, where I will be linking to your book, Gun Control in the Third Reich. I will link to your previous appearance on the show when we talked about the Second Amendment. Of your various books pertaining to the Second Amendment, if people could read only one, do you have a favorite?
Well, the most interesting one to write was called The Founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right to Bear Arms. And that's during the period when the British occupation of the colonies started, 1768, until the last of the founders died in the 1823. That would be Adams and Jefferson. But it takes you through the whole period of the reasons for the Second Amendment, how the British tried to disarm the colonists, not just at Lexington and Concord, but disarm them individually at Boston, for example, and going through the period of the adoption of state bills of rights, which included the right to bear arms. And the whole culture at that time was that an armed society was a good society because it would enable people to defend themselves from both criminals and tyrants. And then the book proceeds through the adoption of the Second Amendment and the aftermath of that. So that's a really, if you like history, the American Revolution, that period, the founder's Second Amendment is a book for you.
All right. We'll link to that as well at tomwoods.com/364. We'll link to your own site. People can find out more about what you're doing and your various books and work and speaking and your scholarly work in the journals as well. So it's all a very, very important corpus of work, and I appreciate that and the time you've spent with us today. Steve Hallbrook, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be on your show again.
All right, gang. Remember, tomwoods.com/364 is the place to go for resources related to this episode. This spring, I am expecting to bombard my Liberty Classroom members with one new course after another. We've got a dozen now, and we've got several in the pipeline ready to go for you guys by spring or early summer. Boom, 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 one right after the other. One by an established faculty member with us, and two by brand new people, all of whom have been guests on this show. You're just going to love it. So make sure you have caught up on your Liberty Classroom material so you'll be ready for that. LibertyClassroom.com, using coupon code SHOW in all caps, gets you the best deal in the history of mankind. When you look at the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lessons you can listen to while you're driving on all different topics, we got a course going through every single chapter of one of the most popular college economics textbooks in the world, and chapter by chapter, an Austrian critique. That's never been done anywhere. It's there at libertyclassroom.com. I teach U.S. history there. Don't just sit there being envious of people who know a lot of stuff. You take this into your own hands, learn the stuff yourself easily with faculty members you can trust while you're driving your car. libertyclassroom.com, coupon code SHOW. Also, please come see me if you can. I will be speaking at American University, April 9th, that's Washington, D.C., and the University of Cincinnati, April 11th. You can find out details on these events on the events page, tomwoods.com/events. I should specify the year is 2015 for people who are finding out about the show later on. I don't want you to show up to an empty hall, so this is 2015 that we're talking about. All right, that's it for today, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.